This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
First question will come from me. Clearly, a museum has an unusual place halfway between both the academy and the general community. Our role is to tell stories to the wider communities and not just to necessarily select interest groups. Once we go to those wider audiences, of course, we engage everybody of all ages and of all disciplines and skills and interests, ranging from children to elderly, right across the board. A lot of the stories that we'll encounter in our experiences are really very traumatic. Someone will tell you everything, down to quite precise detail about the horrors of their experiences. And some of those stories themselves have the capacity to introduce a trauma into the mind of the listener, especially a listener or a viewer who is perhaps untrained in evaluation of materials, which is, again, a lot of our audiences. Now, as a result of this, we have to edit, or sometimes not edit, materials. Our question is, how do we moderate stories? Should we be moderating stories? When does our mediation to make something readable to our audiences, when does it become censorship, or when does it become advocacy? So I'll throw that to all of you too.
Well, I'll start, because the library comes at it, I think, from a slightly different perspective. Our question about editing, and I won't take it down to the interview level, I'll take it to the level of crafting a selection of interviews, which is what we're doing. So by selecting people and selecting stories that are going to be recorded and preserved, that necessarily means a process of editing through not selecting certain people. Okay? So the library is very well aware that in order to shape or select people to interview, we are necessarily shaping the types of stories that people might read or might listen to in the longer term. So we have, in our project, a very strong underlying methodology of understanding a variety of factors about the stories, not necessarily about the people, but the stories that people have told us and where they're coming from, how they have structured those memories before coming and telling the stories to us, as well as the stories that they choose to tell us as well. So that our process of, and it's not editing and it's not censorship, it's a process of selecting that every collecting institution does. We've got a very strong framework that we can account for why we're selecting the people that we do choose to interview, and we have yet to go through a process of saying to someone, you're not in this game, you're not going to be interviewed. Now, if we choose, in the end, if we simply cannot interview everybody, which is highly likely, we're providing people with other opportunities to tell their story through writing their story, or if they've published their autobiographies, then they can come to the collection. If they've got other materials that relate to their life experiences that they want to give us, they can give them to us, so that we have other ways that people will be part of their project if they are not selected for interview. Now, that's a much bigger type of selection than you're talking about. It's a much bigger concept of editing, if that's how you want to look at it. But when you're a historian, I think that historians tend not to think about cultural institutions or collecting institutions as actually part of that process of shaping the historical record. So what I'm saying to you is that in a sense, all libraries and all archives in particular, and the museum staff can speak for the museum, but all libraries and all archives to some extent shape the historical record through the activities of collecting and selecting and rejecting. Okay.
I'm sure you'll have a comment as well. With us it's even a harder process because it's quite a small exhibition and you can only tell so many stories in an exhibition. And how, I think we both quite clear, we need to go to the to make people who were in institutions trust that we have gone to the edges, as it were. How we tell the story of child rape in an exhibition is obviously something quite difficult. We must make people, we must have the responsibility to let people know that child rape did happen in institutions run by the, for which the Australian government was ultimately responsible in the end. How we present that is something we'll have to work out very carefully. But I think the trust that has been given us to our, by our stakeholders is that they believe now, we hope, that many of them believe, that we will tell the story as it was, or how they see it was in this moment. I think, as we've all been saying, there's a kind of a... We understand a story in our time, as it was. The Stolen Generation story had the time when people, ah, I get it now, they got it. That was maybe 10, 15 years ago. Now it's the time of the Forgotten Australian story. People, ah, I get it. I can take it in. I can make it part of my understanding of my nation's history. So it becomes, an exhibition is a kind of moment in time, but we need to include all the things that in that time mattered to the stakeholders who are telling us their stories.
I was interested in this issue, and so I went to Brisbane to meet with the senior curator of the Museum of Brisbane, Jo Besley, who completed her Churchill scholarship in studying the representation of trauma in museum, to talk with her about specific representational methodology. And we're at the early stages of this. Jay and I are still selecting the stories, and so we've then yet to determine the mode of representation. But some of the techniques she talks about are juxtaposition. So rather than turning down the volume on a particular story, rather than rendering it pastel, if you like, it's about using different colour. So it's about you put, you know, very crudely, you know, and it's not as simple as this, but you put a good story next to a bad story so that the modification is in the juxtaposition, not in adjusting the individual stories. That's one technique. And I'm not saying that we will go that way, but this is just because we're talking about it. Another technique is that you have a quiet space within the exhibition space where there are resources available, where people can sit, box of tissues, whatever, that there is a place within the space for them to contemplate, de-roll, whatever, before exiting the space. And another technique which she talks about, and a technique that's come from our Forgotten Australians themselves, is the idea of, you know, that of the resilience, or of the notion of the courage of the survivor, without diminishing the need for services or the issues that they have that need addressing now. Alongside with that is that they are survivors, they are community leaders, they are business people, they, you know, the full breadth of participation in society. So to focus on that as well. So good question. We're still working on that, but whether it's about plurality and juxtaposition. And
certainly mediation, censorship, advocacy, you know, we're trying to keep our balance, but it's not easy.
I'll get the questions in a minute.
Again, I deal with this at somewhat more of a remove. Most of the entries that come into me for editing don't involve personal stories that can be pinned to any one person and even more seldom any one living person. Some of them have been extremely graphic, extremely brutal. I pretty much accept whatever the author of the essay sends to me. I have yet to strike a section because I felt it was not appropriate. And the sense that I have from the survivors with whom I've spoken is that they want this kind of material in there. Again, I've never come across a story where I was able to go to someone and say, oh, here's your story, what, you know, is this okay to put in here? Or even to one of their family members. But their sense is that they are just so thankful that their experiences are being documented. We had a presentation after our first volume came out to a group of survivor volunteers in the museum, and it really opened my eyes to their perspective on the importance of our work. You know, we were seeing it as a reference work, an important reference work, but basically something that goes in a library and people go there to learn about these different places. For the survivors, this was finally documentation of all the unknown places where they had suffered. I mean, everybody's heard of Auschwitz. You know, most people have heard of the Warsaw Ghetto, that sort of thing. But there were thousands of more places that no one's ever heard of that were in danger of sort of disappearing from the record. And so the survivors are very happy that those places are being discussed, that the range of experiences at their most horrible are being discussed within them. I think the only victim group for whom this might be an issue would be homosexuals, because there was a stigma, you know, before, during, and after the Second World War to being a homosexual. There were laws in Germany against homosexuality long after World War II ended. And there have been questions in regard with other projects in the museum about whether or not to identify particular individuals who might have been put into a camp because they were homosexuals. Here again, for us, this has not been an issue because we haven't, you know, they were one fairly small group within the concentration camp system, and we haven't talked about them as individuals in there. For other projects, as I say, this has been more of an issue. We've done a special exhibition on homosexuals and had panel discussions and that sort of thing. So it does come up, but for me, it was not an issue.
Well, thank you very much to all of you. Now I shall throw you to the mercy of our audience. There was one question. I'll just down the back first.
Thank you. Vicky Greaves from the National Film and Sound Archive. My comments are to do with, my question really. I just wonder about the idea of telling stories about a period of history that sort of represents something like a Holocaust. I think, personal individual stories are really valuable as a record. There's no doubt about that. And just by the way, Adele, I was very glad that you said that this was a beginning of a conversation that you were learning all the time, and that you also have good psychological assistance for people that you're interviewing if they feel they need it. I think that's really extremely important because I guess what I'm getting at is that I think... one thing we really need to consider is why. Why are we doing this? Why are we uncovering the stories of individuals? And I think particularly in Australia, when we have a very acute reticence to come to terms with what I see as a connection between our history here and the history of Nazi Germany, in fact. Seeing a film like The Reader... and seeing how people were brought to task for their role in what happened in Germany, whereas in Australia there still seems to be this idea, oh, they thought they were doing the best thing for the children, when in fact it was a movement, it was fashionable, it was part of eugenics that was all over the world, and that in Australia somehow there are people still walking around. And I know this because I've worked with Kinchula Boys Home survivors. And Kinchula Boys Home survivors know these people and they know where they are. Why? Because they'll never forget the horrendous things they did to them. And that is trauma. Having those people still walking around the community without having to account for their behaviour. So when I saw the film The Reader, I thought, my gosh, reading The Reader, to me... asked me about fascism in Australia. And the reason why we have these exhibitions, why we're unmasking the trauma, is this because it's a personal story of whether people are resilient or not? Or is it a story that's actually going to teach us something about what can happen when these sorts of politics get out of control?
I don't think we're using the discourse of individualism, of liberal humanism here. This certainly is an understanding of a social history, not of, you know, who scores the best marks in the resilience test or not. I think, and Jay, you speak a lot about this, about you know, the system, the social.
Yeah, I think we're using personal stories just because I think visitors to museums engage with a personal story better. They'll understand the bigger picture if you enable to take them through a personal story. But I certainly hope that when people come to our exhibition at the end, they see what have we done as a society to children. We allowed a system to treat children this way. We are a country that allowed medical experimentation on children. We are a country that allowed children to be starved and beaten. And what does it say about us? And what does it say about our responsibility? And I often say that, like in South Africa, you have truth and reconciliation. In Australia, we tend to have reconciliation without the truth. We just skip that bit. We skip that bit and move on. Oh, I'm so sorry. But we never say what we're sorry for. So I think in this time, we really want people to know what the... this exhibition is only a tiny thing in the whole big picture. I'm not trying to make it more important than it is. It's only a little, you know.
In section one of our proposed exhibition, I mean, one of the things we're still deciding on objects and narratives, but we have, you know, collected objects from the Children's Magistrates Court of New South Wales so that the objects are just not related to the survivors but to the systemic objects, if you like, the mechanics that brought children into the home. So we are aware, and you know, we do have a quote from Robert Menzies which alludes to eugenics, whether we use it or not, but we have done that research.
I'll just add briefly, one of the things that I really appreciate about working at the Holocaust Museum is that it is not simply a museum of the Holocaust. There is a part of the museum called the Committee on Conscience, that tries to draw the attention of the world and of our government to genocides and potential genocides around the world. And it's something that I think most of the staff are imbued with, that we look upon our museum as almost a safe way for Americans to start to deal with these kinds of issues. Safe in the sense that this is something that happened to people that they don't really know, far away, a long time ago. It's impressive enough, it's emotional enough that it will get to them. And we try at various points throughout the exhibit, throughout the museum, to direct their thoughts toward other similar crimes that have happened in our society and in other societies around the world. At this point, there's, in a sense, sort of a motto for the museum: think about what you saw. The next time you see genocide, the next time you see inhumanity, think about what you saw here. The United States has its own history with eugenics, and I'm sure that most of the people who come to our museum have no idea that the last sterilization took place in the United States in the 1970s, that, you know, this sort of thing went on at all. So it's something that we try to get at. And you know, I hope that our forum is a good one for it.
Question? Oh, sorry.
I'll give you a different sort of answer, Vicky. Some of the origins for the reasons why personal stories are being told so strongly is because that's what people who were in care wanted. They very much, in terms of the record sets, okay, the information that is out there, there's a vast amount of information about... the frameworks for care, the ideology behind why these sort of institutions were set up. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. The records are there. So there's a whole lot of frameworks there. There are a lot of records that talk about the system's interaction with the children. So the court records, the personal files, the attitudes towards children, the system's attitudes towards the individual child. All of that is there. But what has been missing in the record set, which was called for in the Senate inquiries, was the people who went through the experience, their right to tell their story. That was what they asked for. Okay, what do you then do with shaping the collective stories out of the individual stories is a separate issue, but the people who went through those experiences asked for it. Now, the question that I have also goes back to your comment about advocacy, which is if we have all been given the label to use forgotten Australians, and we also have former child migrants, who's actually being forgotten in all these projects? that we're now looking at and thinking through. That's the other flip side of the coin, that the people who see that they have been forgotten up till now may not be all of those who have been forgotten, and that the stories that are being told now may not be the only ones that need to be remembered. That is my challenge as someone who's collecting for the much longer term and creating a set of records whose origins are in the right of reply, but whose purpose may actually be something slightly different.
Thank you. I was also going to ask about the why that you were doing it, and I think you've covered that very well. What I did want to follow on my thinking on that is the conversations that are difficult are the kinds that you have described, where the curators and staff are talking to people who have very difficult, painful, and often terrorized type traumas that they've gone through, and that is a very difficult conversation. But we also have difficulty in these conversations, as at least the museum experienced during parts of the 1990s, when just the mere fact of raising some of these issues were being raised by people didn't want to hear them, or they knew of them and didn't want other people to particularly be hearing of them, so they didn't become a focus. How do you deal with that aspect of the difficult conversation in putting it out there so that people can learn from them?
You mean people who don't want their story told? I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
No, the people like a former prime minister who didn't want to hear the stories that the museum was putting out. He thought it was unbalanced. And there are others who say, you know, why are you doing this? They want those stories buried. So how do you deal with that?
Well, I guess in this case, it's, we're lucky in a sense that the government's asked us to tell this difficult story. I think you can't make people come to the exhibition. You just have to... Speaking of someone who also has been involved in telling strong generation stories, you just tell them. You just have to tell them. If you have the fortune of being an international institution like I have and telling a significant story, you just have to tell it in the best way you can, and people will probably sometimes reject it or say it's not true or you're making it up. Another strong generation, people like Andrew Bolt are still having go at the strong generation saying didn't happen or it was for their own good or other things like that. So I'm not answering this very clearly, am I?
That's exactly what we're doing. And also, it's more, rather than what the response that we're getting in that alludes to the area that you've insightfully articulated is... What we'll get is actually a refusal of help. So, for example, for some former child homes that have a collection, they may not allow us to access it if they think that we are only going to tell the story from forgotten Australians' experiences. So rather than being forbidden, if you like, it's about our challenge is engaging all stakeholders. Now, how we do that is... through saying that we are reflecting all experiences, that we're not being monologic, that, you know, that there is a range of experiences that will be told. But in keeping with, what the former Prime Minister said, the emphasis is on the experience of the survivors and not of the staff. But again, we're still determining that.
Yes, we can't. Because it's such raw history, you say so many people have told this story for the very first time. So it's history that hasn't even become part of our accepted national narrative. So I agree there'll be a lot of resistance, and people don't want it to have happened. They don't want it to have been like that. They wish they didn't know.
It's really interesting. A survivor of a child's home took me on tour of the home that she was in. And that home is now an administration, a building for care services for a particular church. Now, I detected that the staff felt uncomfortable with former residents coming into what was their home, even though after care services have said that they're allowed to, and she'd made former arrangements, she'd done all the right things. This is quite a prominent leader within a community. She's had years and years and years of counselling. She's a really together woman, and she was a very dignified lady, and she was taking me through, and one staff member at her desk turned around and shouted at her for being in her office when she'd received, you know, when she'd received permission, you know. And of course, she's incredibly dignified and dealt with it very well. And I said to her afterwards, you know, she said, well, thank you very much for letting me show you around. And I said, well, you know, why don't we just have a coffee? You know, just I was aware that even though she was dignified, that needed some nurturing time, I think, after that. Not that I was counselling. I'm not. I wasn't doing anything unprofessional. I just coffee and cake. I promise. But the point, I think, what you're saying is that yes, there are people in the community that do want to, that are very uncomfortable with this, and we do see it. I don't know if I've dealt with the how properly, but yeah.
One of the things, and I mean, it's not. It's just a different perspective, and I'm trying to just give you a different perspective from a different cultural institution, is that you've always got the capacity to collect stories, whether they're politically in tune with what the dominant paradigm is or not. Okay? And so the library has been collecting stories from former child migrants, particularly for a long time. And when we were reviewing our collections this time last year to put a website together for the apology, we suddenly started to listen to interviews and find all sorts of people had been interviewed already who come under the label that we now ascribe to being a forgotten Australian, but whose experiences of being in care had already been collected, so that the collecting goes on independent of where the radar is. It's only when someone chooses to engage with that material and make it public that the radar becomes an issue.
On to that issue of how we tell our stories. In this museum, we have under the last government, or the previous prime ministers a few back, no names. Yes, we had strong people with strong opinions about what we should and shouldn't be showing, including some of our council members. Nonetheless, we still managed to do exhibitions on the stolen generations without interference. And we've done one module on resistance, on frontier conflict and other conflicts as well. One of the things is, if the history is honest, it'll speak for itself. The other thing is, curators are really cunning and have an interesting way of slipping something in to say it without being explicit. And the message for everyone, of course, is even if we can't do something, and it hasn't actually happened that we can't do something, except, you know, we just don't have the money for our ideas. It's not just Australia. It had this black armband. See, black armband, view of history. I got RSI writing history, so therefore I have the black armband. People who try to put their fingers in their ears and hum, shut their eyes, you know, fingers shut, hum, the rest of the world isn't doing the same thing. So as much as you might try to compress or hide a history, the rest of the world, the rest of Australia, everybody knows it's there. You're not fooling anyone. And I think that was the message throughout the whole history wars, which was lost, which is don't try and hide it, address it. And we do a good job of that. Okay, next question. Yep.
Hi, just a quick question arising out of opening up that history for discussion. I'm getting a real sense of the complexity of the ethical concerns, obviously, in telling these stories. I was just wondering about ethical considerations in regards to potential perpetrators of these incidences and this traumatic history, and if that's something that you have come across in the collecting process, and do you have, I guess, a way that you're managing that or developing that, or also is there a responsibility to also potentially protect those who may be responsible from potential repercussions if they are named in a public forum or... Yeah.
Allow any individual to be named. We also, I'm trying to think of all my list here. Whenever I speak with anybody, the first thing I say is, if you're considering taking legal action, please consult a lawyer before telling me your story, because apparently, you know, that can harm your case if you've exposed it outside the legal process, so we advise them on that. And some forgotten Australians come back to me and said, well, thank you very much for telling me that, because now can you please, I don't want you to put that thing on the website, you know. And so that's been important. my understanding from legal advice, both from here and from another government department, is, you know, when 10 or more are gathered in one's name, then so if you mention an organisation, and as long as those people, there are 10 or more, it's less likely that any individuals can be identified, so you can mention it. But we're sort of widening the telescope even more and being more cautious, and being careful about even naming dates, so that anyone can say, oh, I know someone who worked there then. Do you not? Yeah? That's a very general shopping list, where it's actually a case-by-case basis where you go over a fine-tooth comb. Mm. So, yes, it's huge ethical considerations. And
yeah. So I think there's an ethical consideration, not ethical, but a consideration the other way, that if we focus on the perpetrators, it's like it cleanses us of responsibility. If only it was that bad nun or that, you know, child-abusing priest or that whatever who were responsible. Obviously, they were immediately, but stepping back, it was a society that allowed it to happen. So, obviously, for legal reasons, we never mention any names, ever. But, again, it's important not to, because then people can focus their anger on that person and think, oh, they were, you know, look what they did, instead of it, look what we did.
Mm. More questions? If not, and we're heading towards two, if any of our council would like to make a summation or anything else you'd like to add... I'll ask one last then. I'm curious about the history of telling stories. With the experiences of the Holocaust, we're looking at the 40s prior, and with these experiences, we're looking at experience of people who are my age. In fact, one of the stories I've read...
And younger.
One of the stories I read was, surprisingly, the experiences of that individual took place in a house 500 metres from where I grew up. So this was effectively a neighbour's experiences. And so that could have been mine or could have been anyone within that generation. Now, does the more we get removed from the event, does in the retelling, the histories get moderated and more moderated filtered, or do they get more filtered? Are you finding the stories that you're receiving now have a lot of the horrors written out, or are they there just not being communicated publicly? Or?
No, in the case of the Holocaust, I'm not finding that anything is being written out. Of course, that generation is passing, but there is a great deal of effort going into getting the testimony of those who remain. I think it's safe to say that any volunteer or survivor who's associated with the museum has had the chance to tell his or her story. And what is, obviously what's included in that or not is up to them, but I'm not aware of anyone, unless they do it for purely internal reasons, writing anything out or being concerned that they shouldn't go into the horrors. I think if anything, the story of Holocaust survivors is that they have become more open over the years to talking about these things. And there's some debate over to what extent the Holocaust was a closed subject for the first few decades after the 40s. It may not have been quite as closed as a lot of people believe, but it is true that a lot of survivors say, well, for a lot of years, I just didn't want to think about it, didn't want to talk about it, I had a life to lead, and only later did I want to open up about it. I don't think that's been a huge issue for us.
Just a follow-up question, I suppose, or reflection on it, is that, I mean, part of what I was thinking about as I heard all the speakers talking about this issue was about when the narrative is a contestable narrative and then when the narrative's in a kind of a social context where, and I'm talking about the narrative in the abstract now, about these stories, when it's at a point where it's become a kind of a social convention. And notwithstanding the great difficulties that still attend to the stories of the Holocaust, I suppose by and large in our societies now, notwithstanding the apologists for the Nazi regime that still exist and the David Irvings of the world, that largely there's a kind of a consensus. And so I was interested in how consensus works with the experience of trauma and even generational trauma, which I think is something we haven't spoken about a lot today, but clearly which attends to both cases, the idea that the trauma is just not in lived experience, but it's in lived experience of each generation that succeeds that. And so that there's something important clearly about social consensus and the management of trauma in those events, which is very different from the Forgotten Australians, where the work that both the library and the museum are doing are actually, I mean, it will be, there will be people that will find this highly contestable, and we know that from what happened around the Stolen Generations. And I was trying to work out what then made that essentially different in terms of how you approach that work. And I'm not convinced that I've nailed this in my mind about what it means to be working in an area of documenting and representing trauma, which is still highly contestable, as opposed to documenting and representing trauma that is has become, to all intents and purposes, part of a social convention. But maybe the panel's got some comments on that.
I think it is something for us, and this relates directly to what I was just saying about the survivors opening up over the years. It may be a chicken and egg kind of situation as to, you know, which came first, but I think part of what helped the survivors to open up about this was greater interest, greater acceptance, and leaving aside, as you say, the wackos and the racists who want to deny that it happened, I think in American society, there have been sort of stages, usually accompanied by some sort of media event. I mean, there was a television series called The Holocaust in the 70s that got a lot of people interested in this. And you combine that with the growing to adulthood of the next generation or the generation after that, who will turn to their parents and grandparents and say, you know, tell me, what's going on? What happened to you? I think there was a sense among many survivors, not only that they didn't want to deal with it, but that nobody else really wanted to hear about it either. You know, who wants to hear about my troubles? As that interest grew over the years, it became more and more acceptable, almost demanded, that people open up about this and share their stories. I suspect that process is not as far along in Australia.
I mean, I look at it slightly differently. I don't only think that we're documenting trauma. I also think we're documenting how people remember. And that's another a layer above the experiences, the memory, and how the collective memory of the experience, as expressed through things like the apology, through the Senate inquiries, through the media reports, how that shapes how individuals feel that their story is validated or not. And quite a lot of the people who've contacted the library, who've not heard about this story through stakeholder organisations, the first thing they'll say to me when they ring up is, I've got a different story to tell. And they've got an entirely different story to the dominant story that is out in the media. And so I think we have to be very careful about making judgments about what the experience is, how people remember, who is being forgotten in all of this. And I think that the process of trauma is but one set of small experiences in a much broader set of stories and memories. It's not to diminish anybody's experience of trauma whatsoever. It's just to say that not only are we looking at the impact of trauma, not just trauma itself, but the lifelong impact of the experiences of being in care, but we're looking at how people then choose to remember and choose to associate with groups for whom remembering is a really important part of their activity. Okay? So I'm looking at it, I think I'm coming from a slightly different angle.
It's kind of strange when you're telling a history that hasn't been told before, in a sense. You realise how often when you are looking at histories has been told before, you come following the pattern unconsciously. And when you haven't got a pattern to follow, it's really quite much aware of it, aware of your previous actions and how, as you say, you're creating this history, you're constructing a story that you're making part of making the pattern, which is a very strange feeling.
And it's interesting you talk about media. We had the Leaving of Liverpool here in ABC and you know, got movies Rabbit Proof Fence, but unless I've missed it, I don't know of any major media event on non-Indigenous wards of the state within Australia. And so within consensus history, there's an understanding of, you know, the kids that got on the boat and the stolen generation. But yes, our challenge is with the...
Just to make a comment on the discussion that we were just having, I grew up in North America in the third quarter of the 20th century, and so, as a migrant, a part of a migrant family. And the expectation then was very much that a generation and a half after first migration, you would basically have cut all your ties with where you came from. And that changed in the last quarter of the 20th century. Jeff mentioned from the 70s onwards, there was an expectation that telling those stories was actually important, as opposed to not telling them was important. And so what we're talking about here and seeing is actually quite different than what has happened for a long time before that. So you mentioned that, you know, you had a structure before and you read older histories as to what was there and you see patterns, but you're now telling a story and you don't have a pattern to follow. It is actually something that has a long time, and the pattern used to be this is the only story to tell, and these others you simply were expected to forget.
Okay, it's 2 o'clock. It's probably time we wrapped up. If you would all join me in thanking our guests.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.